Welcome back to The Wise Man's Page, the daily podcast where we read a page of the wise man's fear and then we chat about it. This is page 95. Denna shrugged, looking around the room indifferently. Kellen is doing well for himself, she said. I merely stand in his reflected light. I nodded my understanding. I thought perhaps you'd found yourself a patron. Nothing so formal as that. Kellen and I are walking about together, as they say in Modeg, and he is showing me my way around the harp. She nodded to where the instrument loomed hugely in the corner. Care to show me what you've learned? I asked. Denna shook her head, embarrassed. Her hair slid down around her shoulders as she did so. I'm not very good yet. I will restrain my natural urge to jeer and hiss, I said graciously. Denna laughed. Fine, just a bit. She walked behind the harp and drew up a tall stool to lean against. Then she lifted her hands to the strings, paused for a long moment, and began to play. The melody was a variant of Bellwether. I smiled. Her playing was slow, almost stately. Too many people think speed is the hallmark of a good musician. It's understandable. What Marie had done at the Aeolian was amazing. But how quickly you can finger notes is the smallest part of music. The real key is timing. It's like telling a joke. Anyone can remember the words. Anyone can repeat it. But making someone laugh requires more than that. Telling a joke faster doesn't make it funnier. As with many things, hesitation is better than hurry. This is why there are so few true musicians. A lot of folks can sing or saw out a tune on a fiddle. A music box can play a song flawlessly again and again, but knowing the notes isn't enough. You have to know how to play them. Speed comes with time and practice, but timing you are born with. You have it or you don't. Denna had it. She moved slowly through the song, but she wasn't plodding. She played it slow as a luxurious kiss. Not that I knew anything of kissing at that point in my life, but as she stood with her arms around the harp, her eyes half-lidded with concentration, her lips slightly pursed, I knew I someday wanted to be kissed with that amount of slow, deliberate care. And she was beautiful. I suppose it should come as no surprise that I have a particular fondness for women with music running through them. But as she played, I saw her for the first time that day. Before, I had been distracted by the difference in her hair, the cut of her dress. But as she played, all that faded from view. I ramble. Suffice to say, she was impressive, though obviously still learning. She struck a few bad notes, but didn't flinch or cringe away from them. As they say, a jeweler knows the uncut gem. And I am. And she was. And so, that's the page. My name's Nick.
I'm Jordana.
I'm Jeremy.
I have a question, just to be sure. Her lips lightly pursed or slightly pursed in your book?
It says lightly in mine.
It says lightly in mine as well.
Okay, I just heard slightly and wasn't sure, and I wanted to be sure.
I probably slurred them together, as you know. So I do agree with Rothfuss's suggestion that timing is very important in music. As they say in jazz, it's not the notes they play, it's the notes they don't play. But I would push back against his assertion that timing is something you have or you don't. This strikes me as something that you would learn as you become better at music.
Yeah, this feels like another quothism.
Yeah.
Well, it seems like Rothfuss is conflating a couple of different things. Because yes, timing is important, but timing can be learned. But talent, or that it factor that some musicians have and some musicians don't, like, that's a real thing, but that's not timing.
It's, I would, like, also argue that a music box has timing.
Yeah, it has timing, but it has no feeling. I feel like feeling is really what he's talking about. Like, it has no, like, creative spark, no,
yeah,
no.
To use the metaphor of telling a joke, which is a metaphor I do like, you need to be able to read the room to get the best timing out of a joke. And I think that might be what he's getting at here with this discussion on timing on this mm-hmm. page.
And, like, timing, but also, like, the intention or the performance of the joke, right? Like, you can tell the joke and wait, like, two beats between the setup and the punchline, and that's timing. But that's not necessarily, if you say it in a monotone, that's still not, like, telling the joke, really. There's something more to it than that. And I feel like Rothfuss doesn't quite...
This reminds me of that sequence in Amadeus, where they're complaining about Mozart's music, and they're like, yes, it was too many notes. Yes, quite, too many notes. Fewer notes next time.
Oh, boy. I also like the are we done talking about the timing aspect of the page? Because I also really like there's an example of an adverb on this page that I don't think Nick can complain about because it's an ironic adverb. When Cloth says, "I will restrain my natural urge to jeer and hiss," I said graciously. The graciously there is doing work.
You know what? I did want to talk about the adverbs on this page because they make a shocking return to the front and center. There's at least three adverbs on this page, but two of them I don't mind. As you say, I don't mind that the irony and graciously, and I also don't mind that the harp is, where is it? The instrument is loomed hugely, which I think is quite funny and a good way of describing Quoth's attitude toward it.
Mm.
And what is the other adverb, the one that you mind?
Denna shrugged, looking around the room indifferently, which also would be fine, but because there's three adverbs on this page, it jumps out at me.
Mm.
I'm easing off my hatred of adverbs in general as something that should never be done, but I think they should be used in moderation.
Mm.
Like all good things.
Mm. Some good things should be used to excess.
Like ice cream.
I said good.
Remember, thing. Jeremy doesn't like ice cream. Remember,
I know, that's why I said it.
Oh, I see.
I see. You're winding me up, Jordana. I see.
I would never. Me? No.
So I also feel like we're getting a pretty honest depiction of Denna here when she's like embarrassed to play in front of Quoth because she knows that Quoth is a really, really good musician and she knows that she is still learning this instrument and she like doesn't want to come off like looking dumb in front of him. She doesn't want to like embarrass herself.
I almost wonder if Quoth inspired her to learn music. Like she's clearly a natural, she's clearly very, very good, but we don't get any impression until she sings the Alawine part that she is musically inclined when we meet her for the first time. So I almost wonder,
a lot of credit.
Yeah, maybe, but it's also would be a neat bit. Like it might also help to serve as an explanation for why he's so important to her because maybe, and he did play the first time he played since being lost in the forest was with Denna around the fire when they were traveling together. Mm-hmm. So it's possible that something there really touched her.
Well, he moved her to tears when he did that.
Exactly. So I'm almost wondering if, and as you say, it might be giving Quoth a lot of credit, but I almost wonder if that was more important to her than we understand yet.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why she's so cagey around Quoth. Like clearly she will play for this Jeffrey character and she'll play around this Kellen guy and she wants to, it's not like she's shy about playing in general.
But she's shy about playing in front of Quoth.
Exactly. And she really wants Quoth to like her, like she wants Quoth to like Kellen because Kellen's the one teaching her music. She wants to impress him at the Aeolian. Like I think there might be something worth reading into here.
I think that it's fair to say that Denna doesn't care what a lot of people think about her, but she does care what Quoth thinks about her.
Yeah, I like that.
That's accurate. The same way that, like, especially for people who don't have a lot of friends, there's just, like, a couple of people whose opinions you care about and, like, you don't care about anyone else's.
Yeah, like me. I don't care about anyone's opinion but yours and all of our listeners.
Friends or more than friends, because I feel like, especially when you are a teenager, there is nothing that is more mortifying than like embarrassing yourself in front of your crush.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, Quoth talks about how he wants to be kissed with that amount of care. I think what he's not saying is he wants to be kissed by Denna.
Yes. Oh,
and
100%.
Also, worth highlighting, I don't think he's ever received that level of care from his romantic partners in the books we've encountered so far. I think most of his sexual partners after Felurian, and including Felurian, are relatively casual. I don't think he's ever really cared about the way Denna is caring about this harp, this song, and I don't think he's got what he's yearning for on this page.
I don't know if I take the same sense.
Right? Like, Quoth has never cared about someone the way Denna cares about that harp, so why should someone care about Quoth the way Denna cares about that harp?
Whoa! You are both reading way too much into the word care. It just means careful. She's like playing with, like, you know, she's playing slowly and purposefully. He wants to be kissed slowly and purposefully.
No, Jeremy, I think care is a word that's been chosen very intentionally because care also means, you know, tender and emotional and lovingly.
Also, you can have a tender and careful kiss with a casual hookup. That's perfectly possible. You don't have to, like, think of them as the love of your life to kiss someone tenderly and carefully.
Right, but you don't think that someone like Kvothe, who has had everyone he's who ever cared for him that much disappear or murdered in front of his eyes, is yearning for that kind of care?
I think that he is. I just take issue with the fact that Denna is... that he's never had it from any of his lovers.
I think that's part of the tragedy of Kvothe, and that's part of why I don't mind the whole Kvothe emerges from the Fae with explicit instructions to conquer all women everywhere and has magical sex powers gifted to him by the goddess of lust. Like, that doesn't bother me, because the trade-off is he will never be loved in the way that he wants to be.
It doesn't bother me because it's cool.
Oh, we have all kinds of opinions on this here podcast.
We sure do. You know who else has opinions? Our readers. Do we have a letter today?
We do.
Good segue.
This letter is from International Warlock Ferguson, who writes, "Set him up and knock him down. Hey, three, just heard page 65. I had been kind of thinking there was too much fiddly details around the Sount and Greysdale mead trick and not enough payoff. It's an interesting and plausible trick, but the care put into describing all the mug, glass materials, etc. seemed a little excessive. Until now. The author knows the scene with the Modigan woman poisoning Kvothe will get reread many times, because how did we miss all that weirdness the first time? I mean, really? You're including the detail that the mug handle was wet and Kvothe wiped his hand on his pants? How did we miss such an obvious thing? So we reread multiple times. Therefore, he must make the scene as smooth and well-paced as he can, and if he lingers over explanations, well, we might notice the odd ones. It's these kinds of thoughtfully planned tricks that A, helped me love the book without the close read, and B, makes the close read fascinating. Thanks for guiding us through it, I.W. Ferguson."
Hmm.
I think that makes sense. I agree that a lot of importance is placed on the Greysdale Mead issue and the movements of the various glasses, the makes and movements of the containers on the table. And it makes sense that if we're used to having the movements of the cups described in such detail, it won't be quite so glaring when it shows up in the poisoning scene. But I also suspect that the same scam writ large will end up somewhere in the future. In fact, isn't that kind of the scam he ends up with the purser at the end of this book? He sort of does like the bait and switch with the purser at the university, where he's pocketing a bunch of the money from the mayor.
Oh, I don't remember. We'll have to wait till we get there.
It's not explicit, and it's a bit of a stretch, I think, to call it the same scam, but maybe that's what that's doing. I just think that with the amount of attention it gets, it would be a shame if we don't see this scam again. Also, that's like a rule of heist movies, right? If they explain a scam to you, like a small-scale con early on, then that con has to come back in a big way later.
Yeah.
Things I didn't know about heist movies.
Yeah, heist movies are almost like mysteries in that, like, they really do hinge on things being set up that then pay off. And if you have a thing in it that hasn't been set up beforehand, you can really only get away with that one time.
Yeah, and the best heist movies, you have to feel like you could have figured out the heist ahead of time if you had been paying better attention, mm-hmm. but you can't actually have figured it out ahead of time, or it's not fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think the difference between a good heist movie and like a bad heist movie is that like bad heist movies rely on a lot of like shocking twists or reveals or double crosses that like, when you look back at the story, like just like narratively don't make sense. Like there's no way you could have seen it coming. Whereas in a good heist movie, like people will still be acting in character or like doing things where you can see them having set that up beforehand.
Mm-hmm.
And speaking of setting things up, I'm going to set up that we should talk to our listeners tomorrow.
On where?
Another page?
Of what?
The Wind.
The Wind.